Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey folks, today's show is brought to you in part by Omaha Steaks. Make home your favorite new restaurant this winter with Omaha Steaks delivered straight to your door. Have you ever wondered what makes Omaha Steaks so good? I think about this all the time. Well, here's the answer for you. It's the aging process. Omaha Steaks are aged at least 21 days. That's where the magic happens. Try these mouthwatering steaks in the Butcher's Bestsellers package. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter the promo code VOICES into the search bar to save over 50% and secure exclusive pricing just for you. Included in the Butcher's Bestsellers package are four iconic fork tender butcher's cut filet mignons, four ultra juicy burgers, four savory pork chops, four kielbasa sausages, four rich and decadent caramel apple tartlets, my favorite thing in the world, and so much more. In addition to getting more than 50% off, you also get four more chicken breasts and four more of those delicious burgers for free. All you have to do is visit omahasteaks.com, type VOICES in the search bar to order the Butcher's Bestsellers package today. Save over 50% plus get four free chicken breasts and four burgers, all from the company that's been bringing people together for over 100 years. That's omahasteaks.com, type VOICES in the search bar. And now let the cartoons begin.
Recorded live in the USA, covering the whole wide world.
Right on!
This is the Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, March 17, 2021, St. Patrick's Day, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. My guest today is author, filmmaker, and publisher Greg Mitchell. We last spoke to Greg back in August about his book, The Beginning or the End. And this week, Greg returns to the show to discuss his latest must-see documentary called Atomic Cover-Up, based on his book of the same name, premiering March 20th through the 30th in the Cinequest Film Festival. Meanwhile, Greg weighed in on the movie Mank with an editorial in the New York Times, and he's also busy publishing a daily newsletter called Between Rock and a Hard Place, gregmitchell.substack.com. Links in the description. Meantime, if you like what you hear today, don't forget to sign up for our bonus content at bobseskashow.com. All right, let's catch up with Greg Mitchell. You have been busy as hell since the last time you were on the show. And I thought I was the busiest guy doing this kind of crap. But man, you are like 1,000 times busier than I am. You directed and produced a documentary based on your book, Atomic Cover-Up. You published an article in the New York Times about the Oscar-nominated film Mank. You started your own Substack newsletter, which is completely comprehensive. I can't wait to talk about that. In fact, I want to talk about all of those things. But let's start with the movie first. I just watched maybe the first half hour, 35 minutes of it. It's about 52 minutes long. It's about the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Similar topics to what we were discussing last time you were on. When will the general public be able to see this movie? I think it's so important. The sooner the better.
Well, actually, they can see it anytime. Mm-hmm. Between March 20 and March 30, thanks to the wonders of the new film festival virtual setups, which they have been forced to go to. Mm-hmm. My film was selected for the major Cinequest Film Festival.
Yeah.
And as with other festivals, they're not doing in-theater productions.
Mm-hmm.
So normally it would be, I'd say, well, my film is in this festival and people are going to attend in person and, you know, maybe some reviews, and then eventually it'll be available to the public if a distributor picks it up or it's streamed on TV. But it's completely different because now they are shown, or they're put up online at the festival. You do have to pay. In my case, it's $3.99 for a ticket, and you can view it at your leisure. You know, you kind of buy your ticket, and then you can watch it anytime you want between March 20 and March 30. And so if anyone's interested, they can go to the Cinequest, C-I-N-E-Q-U-E-S-T site. And so it is actually, you could say that it's totally open to the public
across
the whole country.
Yeah, and I'll put links in the description for everything we're talking about today. So I'll make sure everyone has a direct URL path to everything we discuss. But I'm curious to ask you this in terms of the virtual nature of the film festival. This is sort of a departure from a discussion of the film, but I've been curious about this for the past year or so. Do you feel as if Atomic Cover-Up is going to be better served by an online streaming audience versus a theatrical audience, or would you rather see it shown in a theater?
Well, of course, we all, whether we write books or do anything, like to appear on stage and, you know, be interviewed after a reading or after a showing or something. And, you know, there's certainly something wonderful about, you know, your movie opening or a crowd and everything else. But, you know, the crowds are often small.
Yeah.
And you know, the ability to have so many people see it. And, of course, you know, the film has now been entered. We haven't heard from a number of other festivals. It could be accepted in, you know, a large number or virtually none. Some of them later in the spring will have, if we're lucky, you know, live screenings. But I think your other question was, you know, the how people would react to this film and other films watching it on their, watching it online. Or hopefully more on a laptop than a phone, but... I think my film is, I mean, it's very intimate and it's very, I think in some ways it's probably better to be able to watch it up close and maybe even take a pause now and then. Some films, of course, are kind of made for the widescreen and, you know, big vistas and all that kind of thing. So, I think my film is particularly well suited to a smaller screen for sure.
Yeah, plus I think the audience virtually might actually end up being larger than the audience that would have appeared in a local theater. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, absolutely. Oh, no question about that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a slam dunk. I mean, you know, like I said, it's always a big deal. You can say you've been in a festival and screening and everything, but, you know, crowds are not always that large if it's not a major film.
That's right.
And my film is you know, we can talk about it, but my film is you know, it's challenging for a lot of people. You know, it's I give them credit for accepting it and making a big deal about it and, you know, and screening it because it takes, I don't want to say takes some courage, but it's, you know, a lot of people, it's a subject that's very difficult for a lot of people. And, I think you know. I think it's great that they, you know, they're going for it, and I think others will too. But it's a tough film to market. But I think as a, and notice that will happen.
The movie, the film, all centers around this newsreel footage of the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that was taken by both, I think there was a Japanese news crew on the ground, and then there was also an American news crew on the ground later on. But all of this footage was hidden from both the Japanese and American public for years. The answer to my first question is pretty obvious, I think, but why was it concealed for so long, Greg?
Well, it was, you know, I've written three books on the subject, so this is a subject I've been involved with for almost 40 years in a large way. And, you know, it's simply that when the war ended, the official narrative from the government and from the media was, you know, only these two bombs ended the war. They were the only things that could have ended the war. And, you know, even they were called a blessing from God and things like that. No one wanted that to be challenged, and in fact, as I'm sure you know, it still is not largely challenged. Even last year, when we last talked at the 75th anniversary, the media coverage was overwhelmingly, well, you know, it's too bad a lot of people died, but, you know, it had to be done, and it was basically the right decision and a good thing. And that's so defending that has been important. And what's, you know, what this footage showed, and, you know, as you mentioned, first shot by an elite Japanese newsreel team immediately after the bombings in the first days and weeks, and then by a U.S. military crew that came in a few months later and shot the only color footage, thousands of feet of color footage, and that was all suppressed for decades. Wow. And, you know, one reason was certainly that all of it focused, not exclusively, but had a large focus on the survivors, on the victims, on the people who had suffered, not on buildings. You know, the American public for decades was only allowed to see, you know, leveled buildings and rubble and landscapes. But these focused on individual people. And the problem, of course, not only is Americans were the perpetrators, but the overwhelming number of the dead and the survivors were civilians, women and children mainly. I mean, overwhelmingly. I mean, in Nagasaki, for example, it was about 98%. In Hiroshima, it was about 75%.
Out of curiosity, why was that? Why was it such a high percentage of women and children? Were the men off fighting the war? Is that why? They were just the women and children remaining behind in the cities?
Well, in Hiroshima, the bomb was dropped over the center of the city as planned. That the goal was to kill as many as possible and show the effects of the bomb. So it was not targeted on a military base. It was not targeted any way away from the city. So, you know, I mean, you're right. The majority of people in the city, which was completely destroyed, were, you know, women and children and the elderly. And there was a military base sort of off to the side in Hiroshima, and they took 10,000 casualties associated with that. But that was not the target. The target was the center of the city. Nagasaki was also the target, was the center of the city. The bomb did land a mile or two off target, but it landed directly over the center of the Catholic community in the Far East. So there were about 10,000 Catholics who died in the this sort of, I don't say, suburb of Nagasaki. And there was virtually no military in Nagasaki. So, you know, the estimates are that maybe 200 to 300 military people died in that bombing and, you know, 80,000 civilians.
You mentioned the religious community in the center of the city that took on so many casualties. One of the most haunting things in the documentary is right toward the beginning where they talk about the singing in the aftermath of the bombing. And they were singing, at least from what I could hear, what I could tell from the film, they were singing Silent Night, weren't they?
Right, yeah. Well, this was the largest cathedral in the Far East was in Urakami, which was this section of Nagasaki. Fantastic, massive cathedral, which was completely destroyed. The bomb went off almost overhead. And like I said, this was the Catholic community. So the film pretty much opens with the leader of the American military team, Army officer, with his crew, hearing people, you know, wondering what is going on in this desolate landscape. We hear singing. And so they go up the hill with their cameras, and they come upon, in the ruins of the cathedral, there are parishioners, Japanese Catholics, at the holidays at the end of 1945, singing Silent Night. And so that's captured on camera, and then the film moves on. But, you know, that was, you know, that was the reality. And I mean, what's amazing is that in my film, because so much of this footage was suppressed for decades, there are a lot of images like that that people have never seen. I mean, there are some images in the film that people may recognize from having seen, have been used in other other films in the last few years. But, you know, the bulk of the footage has never been aired before. It's just been sitting at the National Archives. And like I said, people are not necessarily interested in showing it. And of course, for many decades, it was not even it was not even available to be shown.
Describe some of the effects on the people who survived those two blasts. It seems to me as if looking at some of this footage, I'm looking at the injuries sustained by these people, and I'm going, man, they must have been wishing for death. I can think of no other thought process that may have been going through their heads. It's described in the film that it looks like their souls have been ripped out of them, that there's no more humanity really left inside them, staring off into space, shell-shocked by the entire nightmare of it. What were some of the effects of the physical effects on those people due to the atomic bomb?
Well, of course, they varied. Of course, one we can't witness because the people were vaporized, totally disappeared. Others were burned up on the spot from the bomb. Others were burned up in the fires that swept the entire city. Yeah. But in my film and in the aftermath of the bombing, of course, most of the survivors were people who were severely burned and formed hideous scars, et cetera, which we don't try to show too much in the film. I think the film people may feel is fairly subtle, pretty artful, more haunting than graphic.
Yeah.
But we do show some of that. And of course, many others were affected by radiation disease, which seemed maybe at the start not so bad. You know, you're sick.
Yeah.
But then, of course, it develops, your hair falls out, and you get sicker and sicker, and you die. That was something new in the world. And that's, in a way, that's the counter to people. You know, people often say, well, okay, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bad, but we also firebombed Tokyo, and, tens of thousands died throughout Japan from firebombing. So how was this any worse? And, of course, the answer is there are several answers to it, but one of them, of course, is the new element of radiation disease, a particularly awful way to die, is certainly one answer. It was a hideous way to die, and effects they had, and the fears of passing genetic effects on to generations, which is not, in a firebombing, nobody worries about that. So the possible genetic effects, the radiation disease, were just two of the things that make it so different.
And in fact, I kept thinking about the film crews, the newsreel crews, both the Japanese crew and the American crew who were walking that ground, certainly being inundated with whatever remained of the radiation at that point in time. And I think the Japanese crew got the worst end of that deal. As soon as I'm thinking about this, it comes up in the documentary that one of the members of the Japanese newsreel crew considered the assignment a death sentence, to have to go in and shoot this, knowing that there was this radiation at the point in time. And in fact, they didn't know initially that there was an issue with radiation, and then it was discovered. And then from that point forward, well, they've got to deal with that too. And knowing because of some of the other victims of the radiation, the film crew goes in and thinks, oh my God, well, this is it for me, because now I'm going to get hit with this radiation.
Yeah. Well, of course, radiation was, we think it's kind of old hat now, but it was a totally new phenomenon at the time. And certainly the people went in there, even when the Americans went in, they were, I quote the head of the American team just saying, we are given radiation badges, and, they didn't even look at them. And there were a number of the Americans who went in who then suffered possibly linked, cancers afterwards. The filmmakers on all sides were incredibly brave. They went in and were going to do their job, and it was awful. Yeah, I mean, it was awful to experience, awful to have to experience what they saw.
Yeah.
But then to take that risk of shooting it, and then the leaders on both sides. Then the last half of the film is really about the efforts to get this footage out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see both the Japanese and the Americans trying desperately to get the U.S. to release the footage or so they can make films about it or get shown on TV or whatever. So a lot of it is, the filmmakers are kind of heroic in the sense of shooting the footage and then trying for decades to get this footage released.
And it seems trivial given the casualty count on the ground among the civilians to ask about the film crew. Whatever happened to them? Did they succumb to the radiation, both the members of the Japanese crew and the American crew?
Yeah.
What happened to them physically? Did they suffer any effects from the radiation in the long run?
Yeah, I mentioned that a percentage of the American crew definitely did suffer from various cancers. Now, again, you can't link it. That's the problem. It's the same thing with the Japanese crew.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question that they didn't just drop over dead after a few months. So, but as in all these cases, as well as, you know, I think one of the great unexplored stories. Maybe it's the last, outside of my film, of course. The last untold story of World War II is the American occupation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the hundreds of thousands of soldiers.
Yeah.
I've never seen a full book or a full film or anything on the America, you know, the U.S. Military occupying those two atomic cities, and they slept in the ruins, and you know, were bunked nearby and patrolled the city and did all sorts of scientific tests, medical treatment, and everything else. And I've never seen hardly anything on that. So I think my film maybe helps bring that to attention also, the fact that Americans, you know, were in there and subjected to the same aftermath.
Yeah, you know what? It's a fascinating point, because we all see the newsreel footage of various atomic bomb tests and so on, and there are soldiers standing inside the blast radius. Like, they're way too close to what's happening.
Well, they're ordered to march in. They're not only close, but they're ordered to march. Okay, wait 40 minutes and then march under the mushroom cloud.
I mean, was the idea from the Pentagon and the military commanders, was the idea that these guys are just expendable and we could just send them into an irradiated zone without concern for their lives? I mean, was this just considered part of the duty of a soldier to do this, to be expendable like this? Or did they just not know? I mean, how could they justify sending soldiers into a zone that they knew would be deadly? And maybe this is a silly question to ask, but it just it baffles me how they were allowed to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes back to why this footage was suppressed for so long. They didn't want Americans or people in the media or military people to see what the full effects of the bomb were. I think there was a certain sense that, yes, we dropped these bombs and cities were leveled and people died, but people were not shown the images of victims suffering, you know, from their injuries or illness. So that would have challenged the people, people under their command, in terms of who were so many were had to take part in these nuclear tests, you know. And again, there's a lot been said about and written about, you know, the 1950s and duck and cover and everything else, which I certainly experienced as a kid. But, you know, you sort of less attention to the fact we had hundreds of nuclear tests, many of them above ground and fallout in the atmosphere and everything else. So throughout the 1950s, just soldiers and local communities were just, you know, affected by, you know, possible radiation and, you know, just week after week.
Oh, yeah.
So it's an incredible story. But again, it comes back to this is the exact period where this footage was was kept buried. And so I hope my film, which is called Atomic Cover-Up, I'm not sure we've identified.
Yes, we have.
But that's really the root, the root of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, has there been an extensive study in terms of the long-term effects? And this is sort of a tangent, but it's something that I always think about. There was so much nuclear testing going on in the late 40s and the 50s, 60s. I mean, all the way up into the early 80s, I believe. And by the time we got to the 80s, it was below ground and so on. But in terms of above ground tests, has there been any study to determine the overall impact with the entire population of the world from all of those tests? Because it seems like Well, that's a hell of a lot of radiation to be spewing into the environment. Yeah. And while, yeah, the atmosphere can kind of absorb some of that and disperse it, at the same time, it's got to be circulating around into, you know, specific to all of us, you know, American populations and creating cancer clusters. I just think of all of that radiation landing on people miles and miles away. Has there been a study in terms of that and its effect on the population?
Yeah. Well, there have been numerous studies. It's really, really too much to go into, but there have been numerous studies over the years showing that. I don't mean, you know, kind of peacenik studies, but official medical studies and so forth, scientific studies. Yes, and of course, they've found many clusters near the nuclear sites. St. George, Utah is a famous one. Mm. Out in the far west, Nevada, Utah, that whole section of the country, numerous cancer clusters. Mm. You know, a sort of an alarming spike in incidents of such things with, you know, soldiers who participated. And even broader studies about the effects of radiation in the radioactive particles in the atmosphere drifting across the U.S. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies. I mean, I can't remember the numbers anymore, huge numbers of Americans and American children who they estimate over 20 years who got, for example, leukemia mm-hmm. from this stuff in the atmosphere. And I think it's, you know, it's hard to pin down, and, you know, it's certainly partly guesswork, but I don't think anyone challenges the fact that thousands and many tens of thousands of Americans were, and others around the world, were adversely affected by the all this junk in the atmosphere.
Getting back to the movie, I think I mentioned to you last time you were on, Greg, that I am both fascinated and terrified. I think I'm fascinated because I'm terrified of nuclear weapons. I grew up in the 1980s, late 70s, 1980s, and did experience a little bit of that Cold War duck and cover era, just the sort of the tail end of it. But why should American audiences take a hard look at the impact, what these nuclear bombs actually did to human beings? Why should American audiences take this kind of painful and haunting look at the victims of this technology?
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, the cliche is, well, there are victims in every civilians who die in every war, which is true. Yeah. And the other, of course, is World War II was horrendous, and how many tens of millions died. And then, of course, the Japanese were the aggressors, and Pearl Harbor and so forth. Yeah. So all these things are true. But on the other hand, Americans don't like to and are not used to coming face-to-face with victims of their own, what I would call, war crimes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been dozens, if not hundreds, of, for example, Holocaust-related films. But, of course, the Nazis were the perpetrators here, we don't like to see, you know, there certainly were, you know, have been films about Vietnam that, you know, where the Americans were behaved badly and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, this is on a huge scale, you know, like 100,000 people in Hiroshima dying in an instant. You know, that's not something we like to face. It's sort of like the massacre of Native Americans we still don't want to face. So, I mean, that's a difficult thing. But, you know, maybe the larger question is, given that, why should anyone care about this film or this subject today? You know, we can't change the past, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, my point is that, you know, according to all experts, nuclear dangers are rising today. In fact, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts it at the worst dangers since the late 1940s, which most Americans would be surprised to hear that, probably.
Yeah.
But second is America still has a first use policy, or what some people call first strike or first use policy, and that means we retain the right for a president to order a nuclear attack, to initiate a nuclear war, essentially.
Yep.
To use nukes in response to a conventional attack abroad, or even in response to what we perceive as a threat from, you know, that someone is about to declare war on us, or whether it's Iran right now, which is, who do not have nuclear weapons, or North Korea, which does.
Mm-hmm.
But for us to go first. And so when did this policy start? Well, it started in 1945 and has never changed through all the presidents. I mean, Obama considered a no-first-use pledge. People, were, of course, were freaking out under Trump because he seemed all too likely to do it. People maybe calmed down a little bit with Biden, but good old Joe still has his finger near the button and still has a first-use policy.
Mm-hmm.
And what the reason I have been involved with this issue so closely for almost 40 years is, first of all, most Americans don't really realize this. But second, the example of Hiroshima and Nagasaki encourages possible use. As long as the media and officials continue to say, well, you know, it's too bad so many died, but we had to do it. Well, you're basically making exception. You know, you're sort of saying we don't believe in using nuclear weapons, and particularly against cities. You know, what a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
We would never consider dropping a bomb on cities and killing hundreds of thousands of people. But it was worth it twice. You know.
Yeah. Jesus.
And you know, you could say that was a unique situation, and that Japan was bad, and so on and so forth. But you know, everything's a unique situation today.
Yeah.
And so, to me, what has driven me is, and it drives me crazy every major anniversary, particularly when so much of the media, it's just overwhelmingly, well, you know, we had to do it, and but I hope we don't ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But they lay the groundwork for it being used again.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's why I keep coming back. And I know most people, well, 75 years ago, and, you know, we can't do anything about it. And, you know, why do we keep coming back to this, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so I guess that's my answer. It's actually a very topical, extremely topical issue.
Yeah.
Which could, it still could end the world. You know, we're worrying about global warming down the road a few decades. But, the world could still pretty much end tomorrow if there's a nuclear exchange with hundreds of weapons.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's what drives me. That's what drove the making of this film, and hopefully it will have some effect.
And my attitude about the Pacific Theater of the War changed considerably. Strangely enough, when I saw the animated Japanese movie called Grave of the Fireflies, which I think there's a lot of overlap between your film and this animated film. It's a heartbreaking story of a little boy and his sister during the firebombings of Japan when we were dropping incendiary bombs on basically paper cities. Cities entirely where the structures are entirely made of some form of paper, right? And so we're just burning them to the ground with these incendiary bombs. And of course, those also hit people as well and burn those people alive. Why did the United States choose to engage in total war against civilians? Why was that choice made in this case?
Well, it was the same reason the atomic bombs were dropped. It was allegedly to bring the war to a close faster. And of course, this had been initiated in Europe. And there's, Nicholson Baker has written a great book not long ago called Human Smoke, which traces, week by week, the buildup to World War II and the decision by particularly the Brits to start burning German cities. The Germans were bad enough, but, if you read that history, you see that it really was the West that went whole hog on the city burning. Once that taboo came down, you know, it was anything goes. And of course the Germans were the Blitz of London and everything else. So, by the time you got around to 1945, understandably, Americans and others wanted the wars to be over and had no sympathy for the Japanese and could not separate, you know, women and children from the evil Jap, soldiers and leaders. The moral walls come down. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then, of course, then you get into all the analysis after the war, where people, you know, where the experts and the military probers and everything else look into it, and they come up with very mixed results. Was this necessary? Did we have to do that? Could the war have ended earlier?
Yeah.
Or at the same time without killing hundreds of thousands of civilians. So, mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the whole literature that people should look into if they want. But there's, you know, there's this great debates on whether killing civilians, and just, even in the case of Germany, how much did the bombing of cities there hasten the end of the war?
That's right. And, you know, coincidentally, we're talking about the atomic bombing of Japan the day after a gunman in Georgia murdered 8 Asian Americans. I mean, is it any wonder, Greg, we have a problem with gun massacres in this country when our leaders, political leaders, military leaders have routinely engaged in so much problem solving using similar hardware? I mean, is it any wonder in this country we have a violence issue?
Yeah, well, you know, it starts at the top.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, all the police are, you know, look like more like soldiers than soldiers now with
yeah.
the equipment and everything like that. So, it's definitely a militarized society, and, you know, guns everywhere. It's, you know, I mean, that's all you have to look at. Even the Atlanta killer, what do you know, like so many others of these killers, you know, young, male, white, seems to have problems with women, you know.
Yeah.
And when he describes himself, what does he highlight about his passions? Guns. And so almost all these mass killers are gun nuts. And, you know, they're not just like gun owners, you know, they actually are just gun advocates, enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's a difference. You know, you can have gun enthusiasts versus just your average gun owner.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And what's the lesson that we've learned with the nuclear weapons, especially in the earliest days of nuclear weapons? If you've got them, why not try to use a few of them? You know, and that,
yeah,
well, and that is to me with these guys stocking up with arsenals of firearms and so on. At some point, they're going to go, well, look, I've got this arsenal. I might as well use some of it at some point. Otherwise, what's it doing? It's just collecting dust here.
It is kind of amazing that we haven't gone nuclear in all those, particularly in the 50s and 60s. Where we had the hardware and we had some incentive. And, of course, we had Nixon's madman theory, where he wanted the Russians to think we were going to, or the Chinese to think we might, Nixon was so nuts, he might go nuclear at any time. Maybe that's what North Korea was afraid of with Trump, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They recognized he was so nuts, he might use them at any time, so they better write love letters to him.
Yeah,
but,
that was one of my predictions. One of my predictions about the Trump administration, I'm glad did not come true. I'm glad I was wrong about this one prediction. I predicted that if Trump had been elected, which he was, I predicted we'd see at least one mushroom cloud somewhere along the line, whether it was an above ground test or the actual use of a weapon. And that did not happen. I am grateful to have been very wrong on that front.
Yeah.
Well, we came close.
Yeah, we'll see when more memoirs or papers get leaked. If there was various days at the White House where they had to talk him down from that, so
well, it's
wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, let's talk about Mank a little bit here. We've got the Oscar nominations just came out, and back in December, you published a piece about David Fincher's movie about Herman Mankiewicz. What did Fincher get wrong about the history behind the film? It had to do with Upton Sinclair's run for governor, yes?
Yeah, well, you know, that's another one of my hobby horses. I wrote a book, some would still consider my classic book, I guess, on Upton Sinclair's race for governor in 1934.
What was that called?
The Campaign of the Century.
Right.
Which I make the case that it was the Campaign of the Century. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal recently called it one of the 5 greatest books about campaigns ever.
Wow, that's great.
It's quite a thing. In a nutshell, Upton Sinclair was one of the world's most famous socialists, and of course, the Muckraker, and wrote The Jungle, et cetera, et cetera. And he changed his party affiliation from socialist to Democrat after FDR won and ran for governor of California in 1934 and formed one of the greatest mass movements in the history of the U.S. called End Poverty in California, or EPIC.
Wow.
And amazingly won the Democratic primary in a landslide and was headed for victory as governor when the forces of the special interests and Hollywood and all sorts of big business and conservatives and so forth rallied against him and basically invented the modern political campaign with all the dirty tricks and putting advertising people and political consultants for the first time running a campaign, and they ended up defeating him. Now in Mank, they sort of fabricate in a way that Herman Mankiewicz, the screenwriter, becomes appalled by how Hollywood and Irving Thalberg is kind of conspiring to defeat Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mank, a lot of the film is based on him challenging Thalberg, challenging William Randolph Hearst, who was one of the leaders of the opposition. And it's probably one quarter of the film is about this, and ultimately the big plot point in the film is Mankiewicz, against all advice, decides to go ahead and write Citizen Kane for Orson Welles, which of course was a thinly veiled takedown of William Randolph Hearst.
Right.
So you're supposed to believe that Mank was driven to do this mainly because of what happened up poor Upton Sinclair. And as I pointed out in my New York Times article, this is nonsense. Mankiewicz showed no particular interest in Upton Sinclair or did anything and so forth. So and the piece goes on with other things in the film related to that are false. Some of it's true, some of it's very good, and there are various things that are false.
Yeah, one of the things he said wasn't necessarily true, based on what you were just saying, is the film suggests William Randolph Hearst created phony newsreels to smear Sinclair, and that Mank might have written Citizen Kane at least partially as payback, and you're saying that didn't necessarily happen, that was not necessarily his motivation for writing that film?
Yeah, no, there's no evidence of that. Hearst did. Also, the film suggests that Hearst funded MGM doing this when MGM needed no encouragement.
Yeah.
And actually, these newsreels, which were the first attack ads on the screen, the precursor of all the modern commercials we see on TV, hate attack ads on TV, came from this campaign and the use of the newsreel screen to do that. But this came from Irving Thalberg and Louis B. Mayer at MGM. And created these newsreels, some of which were totally false representations, and played a key point in the campaign. So that's what I mean. It is interesting. There are interesting parts of the film that are based on reality, but a lot of it is cockamamie.
Why was so much of Hollywood afraid of Upton Sinclair? Was it a Red Scare thing? Was it a socialism thing? Is that why?
Yeah, he was a famous socialist, and it was kind of amazing. He swept the Democratic primary, and they were, of course, they knew they might suffer financial repercussions. They even, kind of falsely threatened they would move to Florida if he won, which was another way of getting voters to vote out of fear. They never would have done that, but they did fear what would happen. In a more, Sinclair was going to run an FDR-type government, but he certainly had the socialist taint, and so it was pretty easy to smear him.
Was there any validity to the threat to move all film production to Florida? Or because it seems to me contrary to the original intent of Hollywood anyway, which was to get as far away from the copyright owners as possible, which is why it ended up on the so far down on the West Coast. At least, and that's a very simplistic way of putting the motivation. But it seems like that would have never happened. It seems like that was an easy bluff to call, the Florida gambit.
Well, I joke in the book that there was a town in Florida already called Hollywood.
Right, so, right.
It would have been easy, but No, they wouldn't. They had too much invested out there. And I mean, you could say, well, Florida, nice, sunny, you know. But Upton Sinclair would say, like, yeah, they're going to move to Florida with all those mosquitoes and alligators. Yeah. And no way are they going to move down there. So,
as a Sinclair scholar, Greg, what did you think of Bill Nye the Science Guy's portrayal of Sinclair in the movie?
Well, yeah, if you blinked, you'd miss it, I guess. But,
that's true.
He did. He had the look down. I mean, he looks very much, you know, with gray, you know, making his hair gray. He's very thin. I mean, Sinclair was a very thin guy. He was about the same age as Bill Nye, maybe a little younger now. I'm not sure, but he didn't have the voice down. But I thought that those few seconds were he did a good approximation.
Totally took me out of the movie though, because I'm seeing Bill Nye. Right. I'm not seeing Upton Sinclair.
Would, I mean, I was tipped. You know, he's not in the credits, and to me, I mean, I was following it closely. I didn't see hardly anything in the press until the movie dropped that Bill Nye was even in it.
Yeah,
and I had to wonder. Well, and then it became known, but I had to wonder if any more than 10% who watched it cold would have even recognized him. I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have known that was him.
Well, let's switch now to your new Substack newsletter. It is gregmitchell.substack.com. It's an amazing bit of news aggregation, Greg. You've got music news in there, quotes from around the TV dial, tons of politics, like movie news, editorial cartoons. What are some of the specific topics you're covering through this newsletter? What's the overall gist? What's the overall thrust of this publication?
Well, its title is actually Between Rock and a Hard Place.
There you go.
Not a rock. So I'm sort of highlighting the rock. And as at least a few people may know, it goes back to my start in my career. Was in New York. I hate to say how many years ago. 50 years ago this month.
Wow.
At the legendary music magazine Crawdaddy, which I revived after it had gone under.
Yeah.
And then I worked there as an editor for really almost the entire decade. So I do have a long background in sort of music. But then, of course, I've written, you know, a dozen books, most of them in politics and history and so forth. And so I do have this varied background. I've been very involved with films. I've had films optioned, you know, film options for movies, and now, you know, I've directed this film and so forth. So I do kind of have cover the waterfront in a way. Mm-hmm. So I suppose the newsletter reflects that, and that there's but always with humor. So
yeah.
I mean, there's always a couple sort of funny or pointed political cartoons, the best of what's come out in the last day or two, and then various items from around various media of all sorts, and then some jokes from you know, late night comedians and The Onion and places like that, and then we get to at least three, sometimes four, music videos or videos from songs, artists from the past, usually alternate versions or live versions. They're not just standard things. So, you know, you get some very things people have never seen before that I find.
Yeah.
And then I get the latest film trailers. You know, I might be first to post things, you know, some of the best films that have come out in the last few months. And now, you know, just like there are films coming up in the next week or two, there's a, you know, an Aretha Franklin TV series. There's a Tina Turner documentary on HBO.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
You know, a new Guy Clark documentary is just coming out. So I always look, a lot of these are music films that people really don't know much about. So I try to post the trailer when it comes out and write a little bit about it and so forth. So, you know, it's this, and it's sort of exhausting to put this together every day, but, but it's, you know, it seems to be popular. It's hard to judge these things, these new, you know, you've been around long enough to see the various stages that media have gone through the last, you know, 30 years, really. You had the heyday of the blog, remember the heyday of
Oh, well,
you just had people going online, you know, that news outlets going online
right.
in the 90s. You know, so you had the internet, which was an incredible revolution. Then it was like, well, you know, we don't like to go to news sites. Everyone's blogging. So you had blogs kind of be permanent. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, blogs faded and, you know, now everything was Twitter and Instagram and so forth. And now the latest thing is newsletters that end up in your mailbox. I suppose it shows the growing laziness of most readers.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they used to read things in print. Then they would only read things online. Then they would only read things digested in a blog. And then they only wanted to read 140 characters on Twitter. And now they want the damn thing delivered in their email box. And they can, you know, just click on it in the morning or whatever. So, but I'm, you know, I've been early in all of these trends, so
Yeah.
You know, I guess I'm giving this a try, and it seems to be going pretty well.
Well, you're doing a great job. In fact, I was just going to say, this newsletter, if you do a podcast or a radio show or something like that.
That's right. I've not done a podcast yet.
But what I'm saying is this newsletter is great show prep. If you need something to, like a one-stop shop for things, topics that you can talk about on your podcast or on whoever has a podcast can go to this newsletter and get an array of things to discuss on their show, which
remember
is
when people used to do that with Romanesco every day.
Oh yeah. Yeah. In fact, there used to be, back when I was doing radio, there used to be satellite services that would come down. And, I think one was called News Star or something like that, Radio Star. Yeah. And you'd get an entire like cheat sheet of topics to discuss on your radio show, just that they would send around to all the different radio stations. So that's a great resource to have, but it's funny that we're now on to newsletters delivered into people's email inboxes. And I think going back to what you were saying, I think the reason we are where we are, because I'm also publishing on a Substack newsletter, on the Banter newsletter, is...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but yours is totally paid, right?
You it's a subscription.
Yeah, mine
only,
is
right?
still free, and then a lot of people have a mixed model. You know, pay if you can, you know, and... Yeah, but we're not going to force you.
Yeah, right. Well, that's kind of the point. I mean, we started with blogs, as you were saying, and then became the rise of, around 2010 or so, became the rise of the aggregated blogs, where all of the bloggers started to gather together in one place and all blog into sort of one magazine format. And then, and now, because that business model has sort of dried up, where there's no real way to make any money through that, now we've moved on to the newsletter, which is more closely aligned, I think, with the original idea of blogs, which I think is pretty good. I think we're all just searching for a way to pick up a little cash for some of the things that we're doing online, and this seems to be the latest iteration of it.
Right, don't count on making a living out of it. is what's happened with each of these things. I think so.
Well, you hope that it starts as a hobby and then becomes a full-time job, and that seems to be the idea. But it's still the wild, wild west when it comes to digital publishing, isn't it? I mean, there is no template for how to produce online content and make a little money at the process of doing it. You know, Facebook.
The thing with newsletters is the one good thing is that, you know, people subscribe to it, so they're already asking for it, and then they may stop reading it.
Right.
But, you know, okay, you asked for it, so here it is. You know?
There you go.
I'm coming at you with my full personality and my quirks and my prejudices in terms of taste in music or in films or whatever. And if, you know, if you don't like it, but if, you know, if half the people, you know, really love your taste and your where you're coming from politically, then it's, you know, it's kind of cool because they're really locked in.
Well, speaking of taste, you have great taste in music. And before we wrap up, why did you choose to co-produce a film about Beethoven's Ninth? I had no idea that this was actually a thing. What drew you to that composition? Why did you decide to make a movie about it?
Well, I became obsessed. I mean, it's too long of a story, but I finally, after all these decades of my life, I became fully exposed to Beethoven's music and really got obsessed with him about, I don't know, 15 years ago, and, you know, wrote about him a lot and attended dozens of concerts and everything else. And then I hooked up with a guy who was already working on a film on Beethoven's Ninth, the film is really, I mean, it's called Following the Ninth. And I think if you want to go to YouTube, you can find, I think it's now up there for free. You just can watch the whole movie on YouTube called Following the Ninth. And it's a great movie, but what interested me was that it's not just about, it's not like music appreciation, it's about how that the Ninth Symphony has had such a profound political and cultural effect around the world. And it uses examples of, you know, Chile after Pinochet and China after Tiananmen Square and helping bring down the Berlin Wall and things like that. So it's actually a very political film, but it's based around Beethoven's music. So it's the best of both worlds for me.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I can't wait to check that out. That'll be really good. That's
Bill Moyers did a big segment. Yeah, he did a big, like a 12-minute segment on it. He was so blown away. So it was that was a great thing.
Oh yeah, that's a massive endorsement to get Bill Moyers to praise your film. That's an incredible thing.
He showed like he talked about it for like 3 minutes and then showed 9-minute clip from it. So it was quite extraordinary.
Oh hey, congratulations! That's really great. This is going to be my first stop after I post this show. I'm going to look at it.
Moyers isn't on the air anymore, so I wish that could happen with my new film.
I'm gonna watch, if anyone's
out there listening and wants to interview me or show a clip from the film, I'll be all for it.
There you go. Well, Greg Mitchell's film is called Atomic Cover-Up. It'll have its American premiere at the Cinequest Film Festival March 20th through the 30th. That's going to be online. The newsletter is gregmitchell.substack.com. I've got links in the description at bobsesca.com for everything we talked about today, including the film festival, including the newsletter, including the New York Times piece about Mank. Thank you so much, Greg, for returning to the show. You're now part of the official two-timers club. So congratulations, wear it well.
Well, thank you, Bob. I always appreciate coming on. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Greg. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Hold it. Don't nobody move. If you're sick and tired of the commercials on the show, I've got a solution for you. For just $15 per month, you can get the Ultimate Edition of this podcast. Here's what that means. The Ultimate Edition combines the free version of the show with the post-mortem show that we record after the end credits. Plus, we take out all the commercials just for you. That means you get the hour-long free show, plus the 20-minute post-mortem show, where all the real fun happens. And you get all of that without commercials for just $15 per month. That's bobsescashow.com, or just click the All Caps Patreon link beneath the logo at bobsesca.com. Thank you.